May it please the court, Deputy Public Defender Terry Marshall, on behalf of plaintiff appellant Marie Beltran. We come before the court today with two challenges to this statute, one constitutional, one statutory. I'll address the constitutional first because I believe it to be dispositive and then move to the other issue. The ordinance in question here is constitutionally invalid because of vagueness and overbreadth. Beginning with the vagueness issue, the test, of course, being that it must give notice to the citizenry that they are, of what the terms are so that they can comply, or if they choose not to comply, so that they have notice knowing that they don't have, that they are not going to comply. Secondarily, it has to put a governor, give sufficient guidelines so that it does not encourage arbitrary and discriminatory enforcement, a kind of governor on law enforcement. The statute before the court does not, yes, Judge.
Forgive what may be a question I ought to know the answer to, but was your client the, quote, defendant, unquote, who was sleeping in a van next to the pitch tent?
Yes.
Thank you.
Well, as long as we're there, the facts as laid out in the record below are as follows, that on October the 2nd, 02, was sighted in Mokulea Beach Park, sleeping in a van, 10 p.m., I'm sorry, sleeping in a van near a pitch tent, is the way that it was characterized in the moving papers below. And again, there is dispute in those papers as to whether or not he was actually asleep, but for the purposes of argument, we'll submit that he may have been asleep at 10 p.m. Mokulea Beach Park. All right. What we're looking at here is the ordinance against camping, which is not defined, but then refers to another section where it is defined. And the language, if you'll permit me, is camping means the use of a public park for living accommodation purposes, such as sleeping activities or making preparations to sleep. Including the lying down of bedding for the purpose of sleeping, or storing personal belongings, or making any fire, or using any tents, or shelter, or other structure, or vehicle for sleeping, or doing any digging or earth breaking or carrying on cooking activities. Two sentences in this structure. Were that the only sentence, were it to stop at that, we would not have a challenge for vagueness, I don't believe. That would be specific. We might be in here on overbreadth. We might say that was unfair on those grounds, but that would be sufficiently specific. However, when it goes on to the following sentence and says, the above listed activities constitute camping when it reasonably appears, in light of the circumstances, that the participants in conducting these activities are in fact using the area as living accommodation, regardless of the intent of the participants or the nature of any other activities in which they may also be engaging. We would submit to you folks that that second sentence makes the entire thing vague and meaningless. When they have taken the, I would submit initially that the phrase living accommodation has no meaning. And it may be helpful, I think, in the examination to note that this language appears to come out of the CFR, the regulations that were initially applied to national parks throughout the, in the Magma, well, here as well, National Park. In this instance, given the way that people live in Hawaii, given the way that we access the outdoors, given the way that we access the beaches, I would submit that the phrase living accommodation doesn't have any meaning for us. When it goes into the second sentence and then engages in a kind of anti-totality of the circumstances phrasing, when it does away with the intent, the state of mind of the party who's there, and when it says that regardless of any other activities they may be engaged in. So if the enforcer, the person who is reasonably observing, as is referred to here, cannot regard those things, cannot look at the surrounding circumstances, could not even look at an expressed intent, then I would submit that this has no, it loses any kind of meaning at that point. It is vague to the point because what is described here is what is conducted every day of the year here on this island. People go to the beach, they take their furniture, they take their generator, they take their television, they watch the ball games, they eat, they cook, they lay down, they sleep, they put up structures, they do all of those things, and those are not living accommodations. It is impossible for a member of the public in this community to know, based on this statute, when they have crossed the line and moved into an area. It is impossible for them to conform their conduct at that time. The other problem, and the more important problem under the vagueness analysis that's set out in Calandra versus Lawson, as well as in City of Chicago versus Morales, is the idea that the unlimited discretion that is given to law enforcement in these kinds of cases. In this instance, there is nothing that guides law enforcement. It is totally an ad hoc determination. When you look at this, when it takes away the intent, when it takes away, I am assuming that if there's a sign up that says this is the Why Not a Coolie Fishing Group, and we're here for our annual meeting, and we'll be here from 8 until 5, that cannot be considered.
Ms. Marshall, was this same regulation involved in the Clark case?
It was.
And was there any indication in that case that this definition was invalid?
There was not, because that was not the challenge in Clark. In Clark versus CCNV, the challenge there was whether or not it was a free speech and whether or not that it was an expression of speech. And they wanted to bring in, do you want me to tell you this, or they were going to bring in 150 people to sleep, and it was going to be expressive conduct under free speech. It was not challenged as to whether or not it was vague or overbroad. In the previous, because there are three cases.
Well, it was challenged on the basis that it was vague. That was one of the bases for challenging the statute, right? But the court never discussed that.
There is dicta in the previous, in Watt v. CCNV, that talks about it, but it is never the issue that's directly before them. They determine that it's a reasonable limitation, time, place, manner limitation on speech, but it does not go into the discussion of this, so it's not decided versus the Clark.
Just to clear up one small issue, your client didn't bring the motion to dismiss, is that correct?
I beg your pardon?
Your client didn't bring the motion to dismiss below.
My client joined in the motion.
Joined in the motion.
Exactly.
The motion was actually brought by someone else.
That's correct.
And he was the one charged with sleeping in the van next to the tent.
That's correct.
We don't know exactly where your client was or what she was doing, is that correct?
Those facts are not on the record.
That's why I asked. Whether your client was the one sleeping in the van.
I'm sorry, I may not have been clear enough. My client is Marie Beltran.
Yeah.
We are the ones who, okay. But given the state of the record from below, they joined at that level. It's always been set up for appeal. That was their intention. My client, Ms. Beltran, now before you all, operates in the person, in the body, in the action, I would submit to you, of Mr.
So we don't know what she was doing, whether she was in the van, in the tent.
We do not. But by
in the restroom? I mean, we have no idea.
We do not. She may have been boldly wide awake and walking around. We don't know that. But we do know what Mr. Kayave
Mbahili. She was cited and convicted.
She was cited and she entered a no contest plea, reserving her rights for appeal. Is that helpful for you? Sorry. What the concern is, and even I would submit to you that factually it's quite different, the behavior that a person engages in here in Hawaii as opposed to the behavior that might not be permissible in the mall. In the Clark case, it's the mall in Washington, D.C. at the Washington Monument, actually. They're planning to camp all winter. They're explicit in that is their desire. Here, where in order for a person to know they had to get a permit, which is what's required here, that they're supposed to know when they have to get a permit. This ordinance does not, in the definitional portion, does not give them enough information to know when they need to get a permit.
Why would it be difficult for example, a police officer to discern under this definition whether someone was violating it or not? Violating the camping ordinance or not?
Because it encompasses such a huge amount of absolutely permissible behavior. What they're trying to do based
that's
on
your overbroad argument, right?
That's correct. The two are intertwined.
Well, I was asking specifically about the vagueness
right issue.
Why do you say it would be, impossible for a police officer to enforce this definition of camping without acting in an arbitrary manner?
The acts that are listed here are not in and of themselves camping. What the officer, the law enforcement, this reasonable observer is required to do is to make a determination to pick and choose among that at what point it has become a violation of this living accommodation purpose.
Well, the legislative body can define camping any way it wants to, can't it?
So long as it's not unconstitutionally overbroad or vague, that's correct.
Which legislative body defined camping, incidentally?
This comes out of the ordinance of the city and county of Honolulu.
Which ordinance?
One.
Well, let me get to my point, which is that I thought the definition of camping came out of an administrative regulation, an administrative rule promulgated pursuant to Chapter 91.
It comes out of the definition, it's the ordinances, and the ordinance is 10-13. And then it's defined in a separate section, and they are pursuant to the administrative rules, as you say, Justice.
It is defined subsection A2?
It is not.
Where is it defined? Okay. Other than in Rule 3.5?
Other than in 3.5, it is not. I'm sorry.
In other words, am I correct that there is no definition of camping in section 10-1.3?
You are correct. And there is no reference to where that definition is either, although you can go online and find it if you do the research.
Yeah. What is done under this ordinance is that the rule is itself incorporated into the ordinance, right?
It is. I don't believe that we have a strong argument to say that it's too difficult for them to find, that a person can find the rule and can find the definition. Am I understanding your question, Justin?
Well, my question was a little different. Okay. My question was based on the assumption that because the ordinance authorizes the director to promulgate rules, and the ordinance says that these permits are subject or governed by the rules, that in fact the rules are incorporated into the ordinance.
That's correct. I have no challenge for you on that. The issue here for us is the actual language of the definition.
Which part of the definition would encompass conduct that would be considered legal?
I believe that it would have to be fully rewritten, because once that second sentence that is placed in there, the rulemaking authorities can say you cannot be in a park sleeping, period. Or they can say you cannot be in a park after 6 p.m. and before 6 a.m. They can do those kinds of things because they are explicit, they are clear, they give the kind of guidance. But once we move into the language that's here, where it is sufficiently vague and sufficiently arbitrary, I don't believe it can be salvaged by plucking out of it there. We're troubled more by this idea that not only does it the things that it lists, but it also says such as. So we have a kind of limitless view of possibilities that could be that a person seeking to enforce it could rely upon. The concern here, of course, for us is this arbitrary enforcement that seems sort of inevitable under this kind of statutory construction. If we're relying on the officer to determine if they reach living accommodations or not, it seems that the tendency is going to be awfully strong to choose those people who are most vulnerable, those people who look least well off, those people who look as though they might possibly be living on the beach, and we need to take action to be sure that that's not what's happened. That's the intent, that's what's stated in the purpose of the section, that's what they're looking is they do not want there to be temporary housing, and they do not want there to be permanent housing. The problem is, by leaving it this vague and not giving specifics that allow to talk about time or exactly what you can and cannot do, you set up an almost perfect prescription for arbitrary enforcement of the law to go to those people who look shabby, those people who look as though they're out in the sun all the time, those people who look as though they may be living on the beach. And by leaving it solely to the discretion of this reasonable observer to make that determination at the time. On the issue of overbreadth, we believe that it sweeps, the overbreadth is fairly clear. It's a facial challenge on both fronts. If it sweeps too broadly, it clearly sweeps too broadly. It goes into the idea of pull all of these people who are out there watching television, doing whatever they're supposed to, they want to do on the beach. All these people who go out early in the morning, I think they call those the dawn patrol guys who surf, clearly not a surfer, and they go way early in the morning and they sit out there until the waves are ready. It's early, it's dark, they're sitting outside. How do you distinguish those guys from a fellow who is apparently sleeping, not sound asleep maybe, just dozed off, sleeping in his van? What is the difference between this fellow, who's in our case here, and the fellow who's out fishing for whatever fish, blue I think it is, and they've got the poles lined up all the way down the front, and they've got a tent because they're keeping the rest of their gear with them dry, and they've got it under the tent. It sweeps so broadly, it pulls in so many people who are not engaged in any kind of criminal or unlawful conduct. It's impermissibly so. On the issue of the statutory construction, the ICA found, did a very detailed and interesting analysis as to whether or not 702.204 should have applied to the mens rea element in this instance. Our position is that it should, and I recognize that there's some contradiction in our writings in getting to this point. When you have a case where someone is in danger of going to jail for 30 days, is losing their liberty interest, it is required that there be a state of mind element proven to this. 702.204 is what should apply in this instance, and we'd ask the court to, as opposed to this going down to a strict liability. And if the question is, okay, then Terry, why does it say in there, regardless of the intent of the participants? That's not going to the, that is not that explicit determination or the explicit desire of the legislating body to pluck out state of mind, to pluck out that requirement in the way that they have done in some of the sex offender cases, sex offender statutes where they have an explicit purpose and they say very clearly that they do not have a state of mind requirement. It's a strict liability circumstance. That is not what this is. What this is goes to a descriptor of what the observer is observing, not to delete the state of mind.
I don't mean to belabor the point, but are we dealing with a legislative body? Understanding that the city council authorized the director to promulgate rules, that's the director's definition, isn't it?
It is the director's definition.
So is that reflective of legislative intent, the definition?
Justice, I'm going to have to submit to you that I don't know the answer to your question. I'm going to submit to you I don't know the answer to your question. I'm not going to belabor that point either.
When the legislature delegates rulemaking power, which in effect is legislative power, it has in effect given or granted legislative power to the director, right?
Right.
But does it make any difference? I mean, this is still government enforcement of a criminal statute, the ordinance. She was charged under the ordinance, right?
Well, certainly my view of the case prior to the justice's question was exactly that, was that it operates the same and its impact as a legislative rule, legislative making, and it impacts the defendants in the same way.
Do you concede that the definition of camping promulgated by the director of what, the Department of Parks and Recreation, is incorporated by reference into section 10-1.3?
I do. And you're making me nervous because it appears that you think that I shouldn't be conceding that. But
well, I find it interesting.
Not to belabor the point, the defendant was charged and convicted under a particular ordinance.
That's correct.
That ordinance doesn't define what camping is. Doesn't in effect define what the violation is. So the only way that you could get a conviction is to incorporate the definition of camping, because the violation is a violation of the ordinance.
It's true, and I don't believe, that's correct, of course, but I don't believe that they're required to direct any member of the public to exactly where the definition is. They've given this responsibility over to the director, it's been defined, it is the definition that they believe to be adequate, and I think it is incorporated.
And that's what both sides argue. They argue over the, you and the state argue over the definition used in the rule.
Correct. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Ryan Yeh for Respondent, State of Hawaii. The question before the court today is whether or not the Intermediate Court of Appeals gravely erred as a matter of law in finding that the revised ordinance of Honolulu 10-1.3 subsection A2, along with the accompanying definitional section, was not vague beyond a reasonable doubt, thus unconstitutional, and was not overbroad beyond a reasonable doubt, thus unconstitutional. And I believe also the petitioner has brought forth whether or not 702.204 should apply to this ordinance rather than 702.213. Respondent, the state would submit that the Intermediate Court of Appeals has not gravely erred, as the petitioner has not proven beyond a reasonable doubt that the revised ordinance in question today is vague nor overbroad beyond a reasonable doubt. The case law has already shown for precise, substantially similar language that is not overbroad. The U.S. Supreme Court has found that although it may affect somebody's First Amendment rights, that it is a valid, reasonable time, place, and manner restriction on conduct and not overbroad. And that was in Clark versus the Community for Creative Nonviolence, which was previously mentioned by petitioner. Also,
the U.S. Supreme Court didn't really say anything about vagueness or the overbreadth of the particular language, except in the concurring opinion. There was one justice who concurred and mentioned that.
Yes, Your Honor, that was an antecedent case, the Watt versus the Committee for Creative Nonviolence. That was in the lower court at the U.S. District Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, or U.S. Court of Appeals for the District Court of Columbia. In that situation, though, it would indicate that the U.S. District Court had upheld the regulation as being not vague and not overbroad. And when the Court of Appeals reversed, it reversed specifically on the overbreadth issue. And you are correct, Justice, that it was a dissent that mentioned and talked about the vagueness and found that it was not vague as well. So if you're going, and the cert was brought up by the government on the overbreath, since they lost on the overbreath, they did not lose on the vagueness issue. The IC's
U.S. Supreme Court didn't rule on that issue.
Not specifically on that issue, Your Honor. However, I would note that the U.S. Court of Appeals versus District Court of Columbia does also cite, as the ICA did, to Clark versus Community versus CCMV, that the premise does also include the idea that that regulation, the federal regulation, was not vague in U.S. v. Thomas, which was 4 years later, and they specifically cite to Clark versus CCMV in showing that, in its own opinion, that the same federal regulation is not vague beyond a reasonable doubt.
The Department of Parks and Recreation is part of the executive branch of the county, is it not?
I believe it is, Your Honor.
Can the City Council delegate legislative power to a department of the executive branch?
I believe if it is an intent of the legislature to provide definitional and guidance, it's believed that it is within the power of the lawmaking body to do that. I believe it's done in multiple statutes in the Hawaii Penal Code as well, where they assign definitionals to administrative rules as well, which are governed by the executive branch.
What if the legislature enacted a statute that said it shall be unlawful for a person to murder another person? The Supreme Court shall promulgate a rule defining murder. Would that be kosher?
Your Honor, I wouldn't be able to answer that. I haven't researched any of it, so...
Isn't that exactly what the City Council has done here?
I believe that in the situation where the legislative branch is providing notice that the executive or a body of government in this matter, in this case, a rules committee or a department to provide definitionals, I don't believe it would be.
We're dealing with a criminal offense here. It says any person using the recreational and other areas and facilities shall first obtain a permit from the department for the following uses: camping. That's what it says.
Yes, sir.
The definition is promulgated by a department of the executive branch.
And the permit, it needs to come from the executive branch as well, which is why it would be understandable for the executive branch, in this case the Parks and Recreation Department, to provide a definitional section.
Mr. Yee, is it Yee? I'm sorry.
Yee, Your Honor.
Yee, sorry. Mr. Yee, the prosecution, I take it, agrees that this is not a strict liability ordinance. Is that correct?
We would.
But if it
we
were,
would
you think the result is good?
Yes, Your Honor. We.
But your analysis of the ordinance is that it's really not a strict liability ordinance.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, we argued below, we believe that 702.204 is what would apply in this situation, and it is not considered a strict liability. However, if this court...
So, to that extent, everybody disagrees with the ICA. I mean, both of you.
We didn't take the position of the ICA. They are much greater minds than at least me personally in evaluating the case. And however, I did read their analysis of the case, and in all honesty, I couldn't find any grave error in their analysis. And in the way they analyzed it, there is two steps. There is a step of finding that there is a possibility that it's considered a strict liability, but then based on the Hawaii Penal Code, it goes into applying a negligence standard of mens rea to the absolute liability, unless the second step of finding whether or not there is a legislative intent to find that it's purely an absolute liability.
So it's your position that this is not a strict liability ordinance, or that it is a strict liability ordinance?
We would proceed on the grounds that it's 702.204 would apply. So it would not be a strict liability offense at this point. And if...
Would a person on the street be able to apply the second sentence in the definition of camping?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe it would. As previously mentioned, the United States versus Thomas case, U.S. District Court, U.S. Court of Appeals for the District Court of Columbia upheld it. Exact substantially similar language. In California, People v. Scott, although as petitioner pointed out in its petition, there was one additional portion that they had compared to the Hawaii city and county ordinance. However, State would argue that based to consider that the Scott court merely and specifically pointed out that particular phrase, believe it was as exemplified by remaining for prolonged or repetitious periods of time and not associated with ordinary recreational use of a park with one's possessions, as being the, I guess, boost needed in order to get beyond the vagueness argument, State would submit that exemplified just merely means to show or illustrate by example. I believe that the petitioner has not proven beyond a reasonable doubt that a person of ordinary intelligence would not have a reasonable opportunity to imagine on his own that remaining for prolonged or repetitious periods of time not associated with ordinary recreational uses of a park with one's personal possessions would be an example of a living accommodation. So just because you put in an example doesn't make it substantially more, I mean, less vague. I believe that a reasonable person
could qualify it as in Scott, then that makes it very clear, right?
I would say that it's an example. It's maybe more clear, but I don't believe that just with that, that would prove that this particular ordinance is vague beyond a reasonable doubt. And I would also note that
within Scott. Would qualify
all help.
The examples or all the specific examples.
Yes, Your Honor, it would help. However, I would also note that in the Scott case, they do specifically say that even if there was no definition of camping and they just had camping as the action that is prohibited without the permit, that alone would not make it vague beyond a reasonable doubt, as a person of reasonable intelligence would have an idea of what camping means. And likewise, I would say that a person of reasonable intelligence would have an idea of what living accommodation means.
So along those lines, and I promise you to bring a close to my hang up, at least from my end, are you aware of any criminal offense codified in the Hawaii Revised Statutes, say, that requires one to go beyond the four corners of the statute itself and look to an administrative rule in order to understand what is being prohibited?
Off the top of my head, Your Honor, I would not be able to answer that question without further research. In my experience of practicing in the district, in the court system, at the trial court system, we do have many cases where administrative rules are referred back to Hawaii Revised Statutes, which allows for administrative bodies to enact rules which are criminal.
In the context of criminal offenses?
Yes, Your Honor. Especially the Hawaii administrative rules regarding airports and also the Department of Land and Natural Resources regarding wildlife and harbors. So I believe that there are, but I can't, off the top of my head, I wouldn't be able to tell you exactly which ones.
In the Scott case, just to clarify, the court seemed to say, or they did say, that they're not trying to determine whether the evidence was sufficient to convict, but only to determine whether there was probable cause to believe that a public offense was committed. Is that correct, or?
Your Honor, if you could, I apologize, if you could provide me with the citation for that particular quote, I would be able to answer your question better. I believe when there's a vagueness challenge, that all that's required is for the court to examine whether or not a reasonable person of ordinary intelligence would be able to determine whether or not they are in violation of the...
The court seems to be saying we're not looking at this for purposes of conviction, but only for purposes of probable cause.
And Your Honor, I apologize for, if you have exactly where that's said, I'm not sure. I don't have that.
It would be page 181 of 26 Cal Reporter Second. Well, let me ask you another question. When the ordinance says in the definition of camping, the above listed activities constitute camping. regardless of the nature of any other activities in which they may also be engaging. Would that sweep into the definition activity that would be purely innocent? Because it doesn't matter what they're doing, if what they're doing, I guess, is combined with one of the prior examples, then it's a violation of the statute.
And, Your Honor, my short answer would be that even if it did sweep into certain areas that may be considered constitutionally protected, that as case law has shown in Clark, that it is not considered unconstitutionally overbroad. And Clark's language is exactly the same. It says regardless of the intent. And the primary reason is that so there won't be any issues as to enforcement that is unconstitutional in the sense that it's arbitrary based on, you know, one person's protest versus just if the facts show that he is camping, then he's camping. Rather than, you know,
there's really no limit to what the other, what the person might be doing. If he's doing something like sleeping, or I don't know, it says making any fire or storing personal belongings. What if he's doing purely something purely innocent, but for some reason that is part of the activity, then he's subject to a criminal penalty.
I believe that if the reasonable person in
looking activities, sorry.
Yeah. I mean, if the reasonable person in looking at those activities that he sees, as you enumerated, has reasonable belief that this is for living accommodation purposes, if there's additional indicia of that, maybe personal items such as the clothing, multiple days of clothing, clothes hanging out to dry, things like that, I would say that those would be reasonable to make it seem like that he is in violation of the camping statute and he would have notice, and that it is not overbroad, even if his primary purpose is to go and to fish. But if he's using there for living accommodations for the time period that he's there fishing, then that's considered camping. I mean, I believe that is a very commonsensical definitional and interpretation of the term camping.
So if he has a right to fish, or we say, oh, that's one of the fundamental rights, you know, you can go fish, but then he goes to the beach and cooks the fish, then he would be subject to the statute or the rule as...
if he's just there with his... I apologize, Your Honor. If he's just there with just his fishing poles and a fire and a pan, I would say that that's not reasonably appearing that he's making...
Wouldn't that fall within carrying on cooking activities?
That's just one possible factor to consider among many in order to determine whether or not it's a living accommodation.
Also, this person that was sleeping in a van next to a tent,
yes, sir.
How long was the person there? Was there any evidence to that?
No, Your Honor, there's no evidence. And I would submit that all the defendants in these cases all pled no contest, meaning that they they decided not to fight the charges, and they agreed that there were facts to support the charges against them.
So in the Scott case, as far as their ordinance is concerned, they prohibit conduct where, I guess the phrase is, remaining for prolonged or repetitious periods of time not associated with ordinary recreation use of the park. This is missing from the ordinance before us, or the rule before us.
Yes, Your Honor, that phrase
and
is not...
this apparently is something that petitioner is looking at as saying, look, I mean, there's no evidence of or no indication as to how long we were there, or you don't need that. As in the Scott case, prolonged, repetitious, that is a requirement.
I believe that it's in reading the statute and interpreting the term exemplified, it means it's an example of a possible living accommodation, and definitely it would be a strong indicator that he is using it as living accommodation.
Well, you think it's read into it, it's incorporated into that, that
Yes, Your Honor, and the terminology living accommodations. I believe that is one of the factors to consider when determining whether or not it's living accommodations.
So if a person goes out to the beach, Al Moana Park, and sets up a tent, and is there for 2-3 hours sleeping, and he gets up and he cooks, and he's got his personal belongings, is he camping or not camping? Just for 3 hours, 4 hours?
Hypothetically, within that time period, if he has, if a reasonable person, if an officer comes upon the person and sees a full tent with his personal belongings, multiple days worth of clothing, and without knowledge of whether or not he had been there for a longer period of time, I believe it is reasonable to assume that he was camping. But whether or not it would we bring it to court, that's what the trial is for. If he's going to assert that he was only there for a few hours, he was not there to use it as living accommodations, that would be something that would be something for the fact finder to determine.
So in the Scott case, the scenario I just gave you, that person wouldn't be found guilty of camping. Is that right?
If it's just for a few hours, Your Honor,
isn't that the problem? It doesn't give notice to a person as to really what camping is all about under this statute or this rule.
And Your Honor, they would again submit that it does, and it has been supported by prior case law that has been already interpreted exactly the same language without the exemplified portion.
May or may not matter, but did I hear you say that each of the defendants in the course of tendering their no contest pleas admitted that there existed facts that would support a conviction?
I believe that when you enter a no contest plea, that is what you are doing.
No, you aren't.
Okay, I apologize.
Not unless you're asked. Do you know whether the record reflects any such concessions?
I wouldn't be able to answer that at this time. I didn't bring the transcripts the minuscule amount of transcripts that we actually have for this case, Your Honor. I apologize.
Mr. Ye, is the camping without a permit ordinance utilized to rouse people who sleep in their cars?
Your Honor, if it looks like he's using it for living accommodation purposes in a public park area where you're required to have a camping without a permit, then yes. If he fits the definition of what reasonably appears that he is.
So just sleeping in your car alone isn't going to get you arrested for camping without a permit?
No, Your Honor. Usually, actually, they do have another ordinance for that. I believe there is. There's actually a couple for specifically within a car, Your Honor.
Well, that ordinance only applies from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., right? 6 p.m. to 6 a.m.
I believe there's that, and as well as I think there's inhabiting within a vehicle as well, which is another.
So sleeping doesn't necessarily mean inhabiting or using it as a living accommodation.
Yes. I'm not, the 6 p.m. to 6 a.m., I'm not quite sure if that's the exact wording for that ordinance. And so I wouldn't be able to answer if that's exactly what it
should be the other way around. Sorry.
6 a.m., yeah. And Your Honor, I would just conclude and say that again that the petitioner has not proven beyond a reasonable doubt, especially based on the precedent case law on statutes very substantially similar to this one, to this ordinance, and regulations substantially similar to this ordinance, that the ordinance is vague beyond a reasonable doubt or overbroad beyond a reasonable doubt. And in terms of whether or not the ICA gravely erred in determining that there's a negligent state of mind that can be charged under this ordinance, they would just submit and defer to the court on that matter. If there are no further questions, thank you.
Just address a couple of questions that the court brought up. Justice Moody, in terms of the question is whether under the Scott formulation of the law, what happens in Scott is when I would disagree with the state in its interpretation that the phrasing as exemplified by remaining for prolonged or repetitious periods not associated with ordinary recreational use of a park is the same formulation that we have in here. That cannot be read into the statute that we're, the ordinance, the definition that we have here, because it goes specifically to the idea of what is trying to be prevented, I believe, here. It goes specifically to the idea of being there. It takes into account the time constraint, the time. Here's what's happening. This is the idea of the tragedy of the commons. You have this shared space, and the concern on the part of the government is that some people are getting more than their share of the shared space, and they want to stop that. They don't want people living in there. They don't want people overusing it. They articulate it clearly in the purpose that that's what they're trying to do. They don't want people living there. But they go too far when they give us this vague language. If they really wanted to address that problem skillfully, constitutionally, appropriately, they would have something like what they have in Scott. They would say, not this much more time. And you see what the facts in Scott are. Where they see the guy lying on a mattress, they see him there on more than one occasion, they give him a warning, they note that he has personal possessions there with him, they have an interaction, law enforcement has an interaction with him, such that they can make a fair, reasonable determination, and that man, Mr. Scott, could know that he had gone too far, that he had taken more of his share. It's clear in the way that our statute is not, because the example that you gave when you said the fellow who falls asleep for 3 hours in the afternoon, maybe whatever, between his jobs or while he's waiting on his kid to get out of school, he falls asleep in the park, is he camping? And under our statute, he is camping. He is there. He is operating to have living accommodation. He is taking something, because there's nothing that precludes in the way the sort of time constraints do. The Scott circumstance, there's nothing that precludes them from going there. That's the error in ours. It's broadness, and on both ends, I think I talk about this from the perspective of the idea of the public defender, the client who doesn't have any money and may be pushing the line out there in the park and may be staying a little more than what people, but for the other side of the spectrum, for people who are just trying to have their family picnic on Sunday, how do they know? Because they are the people who can bring all the accoutrement with them of living accommodation. They can bring all of that stuff with them. And you know, our court for a long time now, going all the way back to Avellano and before, but there is this clear articulation through Avellano, Chigamasu, that we have a constitutional right to be outside, to lay our mattresses down, our blankets down, and to enjoy. We have the constitutional freedoms of movement, of association, all of those things that are associated with being at a beach park, as well as the privacy. We have the privacy to go there. We have the privacy to sleep in our car in the afternoon, and we have the privacy to be out all night fishing if that's what we want to do. And if we've got a cooler in our car and we've got pop in the cooler, all of those things, we have the constitutional right to be doing things like that without having to worry that it's going to be misinterpreted. And to say there's a state with no disrespect says, well, then it gets to the court and it'll get sorted out. Absolutely not. And the law is clear on that as well. You don't just throw the big net, pull everybody in, and then say, oh, well, y'all can sort it out when you get to court. It's hugely inconvenient to go to court. It's expensive to go to court. You may not qualify for a public defender. You may have to go 4 or 5 times to go to court. We don't cast that wide net and then just yank everybody in and say, y'all figure it out later. United States versus Reese, 1875, long time now, we've held to this idea that you get to be not bothered by the government when you're minding your own business. And that's what we have going on here, people who are minding their own business. Our case, Mr. Kaavi Mauhili, is asleep at 10 p.m. Is that overnight? Does that look like he's living there? Are there any facts to support the idea that he's got his whole household set up there? Absolutely not. He's not even in that tent. He is sleeping there. They have overreached. It is vague. And he is so susceptible. Just, we're here because of this. He is so susceptible to law enforcement that is making an ad hoc determination. We're here. It seems quite clear. It's not a kind of analysis. It's not the thing that gives free rein to whatever law enforcement officer is out there and says, you look like the kind.
Ms. Marshall, what about the cases Mr. Ye referred to that said, well, this camping definition is not vague or ambiguous?
Thomas, for our case here, and I believe that we can distinguish
from that here under the Hawaii Constitution. We have a constitutional right, and it's enshrined to privacy. And we are able, under our Constitution, we are able to go beyond what the federal Constitution allows. Our Constitution, our courts, and this court has done it before, has found that we are entitled to additional rights, fuller rights, and we have freedom of movement, freedom of association, and privacy. And this, for us, I don't think this is a distinction without meaning. I think that to talk about living in Hawaii and the way that we live our lives, to talk about camping in Wyoming may have one meaning, but to talk about what we do here and how we live our lives here has a different meaning, and I think we see that every day. So the fact that the Supreme Court has held the way it held in U.S. v. Thomas does not deny this court its opportunity to protect the citizens of Hawaii. And the thing I really don't like, I need to take back the concession that it is not a problem that the director of camping, the definition of camping, appears in the rule and not the ordinance. The rules are enacted by the director, and the executive does not have the authority to do this criminal statute. It also creates further vagueness problem in that the definition is not within the written statute. I think that's, it's so distinct and so separate that the person surely even wanting to be law-abiding would not know where to go to find the statute. We're asking this court to overturn the ICA, to find that the statute as presented, as written, is constitutionally invalid because of its vagueness and because of its overbreadth, and we're asking the court to remand this for the appropriate proceedings thereto, and we're asking this court to find that the requirements of 702-204 should attach to this, albeit that's, the court doesn't have to reach that. Any questions? Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take this matter under advisement.
Supreme Court seat of life and adjourn for the vote.